Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco at the club's new facility at 110 Embarcadero and our online and radio audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce my friend Douglas Kenning, who is widely known here in San Francisco as a lecturer on lots of topics in the ancient Greek world. And in addition to that, he runs Sicily Tour, lives in Sicily half the year, and is well known for his work there. And he's here to talk to us about the influence that the Phoenicians had on the Greeks to bring them out of their dark ages. So, Douglas.
Thank you, George. Well, welcome. A lovely group tonight. Okay. The conference this tomorrow and Saturday is on the archaic Greek world. My lecture here is to give us a running start to get there. How did that world appear? Why did that world appear? And next year, the Humanities West is doing a conference on the previous period, the Mycenaean world, the Bronze Age world, and there's a gap between that world and the world of tomorrow's program, and that gap is called the Dark Ages, and we're going to talk about that in this period. As he mentioned, this September, we're running a Humanities West tour of Greece that I'm leading that will hit many of the Mycenaean sites, so it'll apply to this weekend's program as well as next year's program, so see me if you're interested. It's on the website also under travel. The Rape of Europa. There she is. We live in a Bay Area, Silicon Valley. As any entrepreneur knows, grabbing the bull by the horns can get you abducted, abducted into a future that you had not envisioned. And you can take the rest of civilization with you, which is what happened in Silicon Valley. So here's a mythic version of that. But we're going to launch ourselves into this, beginning with the Mycenaean period. Here we have the end of the Mycenaean period, a thriving, wonderful, marvelous civilization, fabulous in terms of fable. It's fabulous in that way. And it fell apart. It went boom. And it collapsed in the late Bronze Age collapse, one of the great moments, the most pivotal moments of world history. And the Bronze Age collapse, the Hittites were driven back. The Egyptians were battered. The Assyrians were battered. Look at all the burning city. I wish, this is weird, because you're all looking that way, and nobody's looking at, but it's okay. I could sit in the back and do this, and you all look at things. Look at the burning cities all over the Mediterranean area, all about the same time, all about the year 1200, give or take a few decades either side. Terrible things were happening. We don't know why. We don't know who did it. It's smoking guns everywhere. There's dead bodies everywhere, but we don't know who did it. Notice that the town of Tyre is not burning. Tyre right here on the coast of Lebanon. My thing doesn't quite reach there. And sort of like the North Bay fires last autumn, you know, there's devastation everywhere. People are losing their homes, but somebody somewhere is going to make money out of this. And so the people of Tyre are going to make money out of all those burning fires. But first place, we have all the bullies of the region, all the big players have been kicked back. Now, from the Greek point of view, the standard take on this moment was the old Doric invasion in quotation marks. But we don't know now what that means, because the Dorians came in from the north, and the Ionians, who were the ex-Mycenaeans, who had their whole society fall apart, fled to the east, and that was always, for 2,500 years, scholars have said that, have talked about, even the ancient Greeks talked about the Dorian invasion. Lately, we don't quite buy that anymore. Perhaps a Dorian migration, which is what this map suggests, a Dorian migration, instead of an invasion. We have Aeolians. You can follow the arrows across the Aegean, north to south, red, purple, and blue. The Aeolians crossing to the northwest Aegean on the coast of Anatolia. The Ionians from Attica around Athens fleeing across to the central part of the eastern Aegean Sea. And you have the Dorians in the blue finally following them, themselves crossing over to Crete and the coast of Anatolia. Folks on the move, folks being displaced, terrible time. Legend has it that the Dorians arrived as a result of the rulers of Argos, the Argolids, being displaced from Argos. And they promised they'd come back and claimed they were the descendants of Hercules, Heracles, and called the Heraclidae. And they supposedly the Dorian invasion was the revenge or return of the Heraclidae. It's a muddled picture. That's what Euripides is writing about in his play. But either way, what arrived with the Dorians was not civilization as we know it. Terrible violence, maybe civil war. The top end of society was amputated. The wealthy were killed off. Culture was in ruins. And kings who were themselves, if not actually divine, semi-divine, were under divine protection. Suddenly the bodies of kings are littering if the kings are being killed or driven off, the gods are displeased. And what happened to our conception of the kings? And when you have a society that's top heavy, where all the power is concentrated at the peak with the king, or the Wanax, or the Anax, what you might call him in the Mycenaean world, if that's cut off, everything collapses. The people are not robust enough, society's not robust enough to survive that sort of amputation at the top. You have total social collapse. What was lost in that fall of the Mycenaeans? Huge stone structures were lost. No more big stone buildings. Beautiful palaces, gone. And the class of people who inhabited them. Fresco and wall paintings, gone. Sophisticated society. This is Pylos in Mycenae, one of the places we're going to on the tour. Lost, gone. Sophisticated vase painting. Mycenaean Minoan, gone. Seals, other engraving, quality engravings, gone. Metals and the import of fancy metals from places that weren't destroyed, places like Egypt and the Near East. Although they were set back by the late Bronze Age collapse, they were only temporarily in remission, and then finally they didn't lose their civilization. But all the goods that might have come from these people gone, from Greece. Writing, gone. It wasn't a literate society, but there were people who wrote in the Mycenaean world. Gone, writing and literacy. There it goes. Writing is pretty fragile anyway, because when you have a society like the Mycenaeans with only a few scribes whose main job was to keep records for the boss, when that falls apart and you're 1% of society who could write is gone or isn't writing anymore, has no one to write for, literacy disappears. And when everyone's illiterate, nobody cares. Nobody knows what they're missing. Massive population collapse happened. Prosperity was gone. Survival became dependent on local farming. And in Greece, the soils are bad, so you don't make anything from farming. You're lucky to get by. It's very resource poor, Greece is. Dark ages. The door slams, and you go into a new room. Scholars refer to these as the Dark Ages, but they use that word also for the fall of the Roman Empire. But it's a similar thing in one respect, in that several centuries, we know relatively little what goes on. The Greeks themselves, of two centuries later, didn't really know anything about their own dark ages a few centuries before. It's dark also for us because we can't see what they were doing. We don't have much writing, no writing, no record of them. Archaeological record, pretty blank. We can't see them, so it's dark to us. Janitor, shut off the lights, let's all leave. Dark. No point in doing anything. Hard time, a poor time, a wretched time. The sea trade was lost, so there's no connection to the outside world. Remember, there were Mycenaeans who did travel back and forth to the east, to the eastern Mediterranean, to Cyprus and Crete and beyond, but that was stopped. Pretty much stopped. We'll talk about the part that wasn't. But in Greece itself, when we archaeologists dig into the towns and dig into the archaeological sites, they don't find foreign implements anymore. They don't find stuff from the east, stuff from Egypt. No jewels, no nothing. And nor do we find Greek stuff in those places from this period. So nobody was trading with Greece, and Greece wasn't trading with anybody else. Isolated from exterior trade. lost productivity, no reason. That was exterior, but even within themselves, there was no trade. You have people living isolated, small communities in valleys between mountains, cut off from each other. So stagnation, localization, localism, they're all locavores. There's no choice. Think of the European Middle Ages after the Dark Ages of the fall of Rome. Those places were cut off from one another. And because no one's in charge, then there's no one keeping the, there's no one building roads, there's no one maintaining the roads, there's no one securing the roads. So you venture out onto the road, you can get killed or robbed. And so when there's no one in charge, it's a dark time. And of course, this being Greece, there's a myth that tells this story. It's the myth of Theseus, the first part of the myth of Theseus. Here's Theseus heading out from Troezen, which is down there, and along the coast, around the Gulf, and you see that following the numbers, heading to take his rightful place as king of Athens, so he was told he was. So off he goes. And on the way, he meets horrible stuff. At Epidaurus, on the road, you can get attacked. When you're on the road, you can get attacked at any moment. Well, Epidaurus, he got attacked by Perites, who beat his opponents into the earth. On the road, there are strangers who lack law, in our opinion. Barbaric cruelty. He met a guy who tied up passersby to two palm trees and then released the thing in the palm trees, tore them in half, tore them apart. There's dangerous animals along the road. At Chromium, he met a wild sow who was tearing up the countryside. On the road, you can't trust the locals you meet, even when they appear to be worthy of trust or people you want to help. At Megara Skyron, he meets an old man who he tries to help and gets him, and who anyone who tried to help them, him, would get kicked off the cliff. At Eleusis, he got tricked into wrestling, and you have to wrestle to save his life. And then there's Procrustes, the B&B owner from hell, who amputated or stretched your, not your budget, but your body. So all the stuff, the dangers of the road, which are really familiar in terms of our own fears of being on the road, were multiplied. And this is not a civilized society. There is normally in ancient societies, travelers were respected. Travelers weren't preyed upon because everyone is a traveler in a strange land, and the merchants went back and forth. And even though there may not have been an overall law, travelers were respected. It's from the Mediterranean to the Scottish Highlands. There's a code about travelers, that you left them alone and you hosted them. Not here, not in this Greece, in this ancient age, or so the myth says. And the myth of Theseus tells us what it was like. Pottery was pretty miserable, pretty dull stuff, compared with two centuries before and compared with what other people were doing around the Mediterranean. And you could tell where the pots come from very distinctly, whether they're from Athens or the area around Attica or Boeotia or someplace, because they were very distinctive locally, which suggests that they weren't trading among each other. They weren't passing ideas around. The pots were local and stayed local. This is another indication of isolation. The international system of trade depended on the existence of a central palace and a strong central authority keeping things order, as I just indicated. That's gone. The Greeks lived in villages, and small villages because the population collapsed. On the other side, that sort of situation is more egalitarian. When the king, who's above everyone else, disappears, and the fact that he was protected by the gods is proven false or that the gods disapproved of him, suddenly you realize you're on your own. And that develops, like the English yeomen of the Middle Ages, it develops a class of people who later on, their descendants or descendants, are more independent-minded. And so you have several steps towards democracy by this decapitation of the aristocracy. The people have developed a sense of themselves. So that was a long way down the road. Meanwhile, they're fighting to eat every day, or so it seems. And not even any wars. Not only no indications of civilization, but not even any big-scale wars are going on. Really, it's quietude. It's historical quietude. It's archaeological quietude. It's not entirely quiet. If you were there, you'd hear one thing. People were singing, and they were telling stories. Folk memory needs no aristocracy. It needs no infrastructure. It needs no trade. They're telling legends, and the people's legend is their history. No, legend is not history by our standards, by the later Greek standards, Herodotus and his followers. But anyone who says that legends are completely useless as indicators of history are wrong. As wrong as anyone who says legends are totally right and correct in history themselves. So you take the legend, you take them seriously. The Greeks always knew in these dark ages and after that there was a heroic age who come before. They knew there was this great age, the Mycenaean age we're talking about. They knew it because of the stories they had. An earlier age where people were bigger and stronger and more heroic and more noble than we are now. As Hesiod tells us at the end of this dark period, Hesiod tells us that we're all living in a degraded times and we're all lesser, inferior beings compared to the way human beings used to be. And they knew that because that was what the myths told them. So all we had to look at was the stories of, as if we were living in that time, the Dark Ages, all we had to look at was at these stories to tell us about our own history and to tell us, put us in our place in terms of how we were. It's interesting, the heroism is a very important subject to the Greeks, very much about part of their ethos. And Dr. Martin is going to elaborate on that in the conference that's upcoming about how heroism evolved and developed. An epic tradition, the tradition of stories of heroes are always in the form of epics. So, and how well did it survive? Long subject. How accurate did it go? It's a Chinese word game going on here, whisper game. But these guys were professionals, and their job, these bards, and their job depended upon their memory. And so we've got a pretty good sense now, or people have theories at least, of how much was retained and how much was not. But it wasn't just the Homeric tales, but all manner of stuff, all manner of stories got passed on. Upper left, Tiamat and Apsu had played in upon the stories of Zeus and Hera. Hesiod's Theogony is taken out of, you can find evidences of it, echoes of it, of ancient Mesopotamian, Babylonian myths. You find Oceanus and Thetis down in the top center, suggesting also the Apsu and Tiamat story. And also Aphrodite, derives perhaps from Ishtar. Aphrodite, who's the daughter of Dione and Zeus, echoes in ancient Ishtar and Inanna stories. Prometheus echoes Enki stories from Mesopotamia. The flood story, you find it bounced around the Mediterranean. You find the Greek flood story of Deucalion echoing the ancient. So these stories got into Greece somehow, and they got in there by these bards telling these stories and keeping those stories going. So we've got something there. The Greeks were destined to become great seafarers. Never happy seafarers, but skilled seafarers. But it took them many years, many ages, to relearn the seafaring skills that the Minoans had, that the Mycenaeans didn't really have much, although they did, but the Greeks, they were lost, and then they had to relearn those. Meanwhile, who's doing the trading, if any, in the Mediterranean? Well, we find in Homeric poems, other sources, that in the Aegean, for several centuries, three or four centuries, during what we call the Dark Ages, there were people plying and people doing trade in there, some, not much, but there was a backwater, but there was trade, and it was being done more less by Greeks than by the Phoenicians. We have the indication here of that Doric, Ionic, Greek division. So you have the Dorians coming in from the Balkans, probably, filling in these blue areas, bringing in a much inferior, much more tribal organization and pushing the more sophisticated Mycenaeans and their followers out into the Ionian, the red areas in the Aegean. And those folks were slightly more sophisticated and slightly more inclined to trade with the East. But still, everybody was in the Dark Ages, and so this is a small difference at this point. But it's a difference that becomes magnified. So trade throughout the Aegean and the East, the Mediterranean, in fact, in general, as we get into these Dark Ages, were being done by Phoenicians. The Phoenicians were the guys, Phoenician merchants. They came to Greece and Crete. Occasionally, the Greeks would go the other way, but the Phoenicians were the ones, and the Carians also. The Carians are in the southwest corner of Anatolia. They were also sea traders, but they're not really a part of our story. So who were the Phoenicians? Good question. Very important. Don't get nearly enough press. There they are on the coast of what is now Lebanon, northern Israel. The red Phoenician cities along that coast, what we call the Levant. Phoenicians were Canaanites. They were Semites, like the Jews and Arabs. They were Baal worshippers. So their religion pops up in the Bible all the time. In fact, the Bible generally calls them Canaanites. Although Canaanite applies to lots of folks, not only Phoenicians. But the Phoenicians dominated the region culturally. So that's who the Phoenicians were. The greatest ancient businessmen as well. And that's more or less central to our story. From those city-states on the coast. And because they're on the coast, they were the greatest of ancient sailors. The traveling salesmen of the ancient world. They always traded, or tend to trade, not always, but they tended to trade other people's goods. This, for instance, is not a Phoenician. But they not only traded other people's goods, but they did imitations of other people's goods. So here are the Phoenicians imitating Egypt and selling it to somebody else. Maybe they're selling it as an Egyptian object. Who knows what the sales terms were? But that's we find the Phoenicians doing imitations of other people's stuff. Here's a head going the other way. That one went from up north. This one comes from Cyprus. And see, Phoenicians not only selling stuff out of their own ports, they were going from the Etruscans to the Egyptians, from the Assyrians to the Greeks, from the Greeks to the Nabataeans. They were moving stuff all around. And here's coming from Cyprus down to Egypt. We find this in Egypt, but being sold by Phoenicians because they're coming out of Cyprus. What would the Phoenicians look like? Did they look like this? Hard to say, perhaps, although he's probably a Cypriot. Doesn't mean he's a Phoenician. Their Phoenicians were in Cyprus, as we're going to see, but I don't know. He's a good face. But the Phoenicians' own products, the stuff that they did really well, was glass and purple dye. That was a claim to fame, with that famous royal dye, royal purple, and glass. How about these faces? These guys might be Phoenicians. Little glass beads, glass amulets, probably of spirits. Certainly in one or two of them are demonic spirits, probably of good and bad spirits. Who knows whose faces they used, but those two are Phoenicians. They were the specialists in glass. Very tiny, these things. Quite small, warm around your neck. Well, the best picture we have of what a Phoenician looked like is her. And we had to go back to the Mycenaeans to get a portrait of a Phoenician. There she is on the wall of a Mycenaean palace, which suggests the importance of the Phoenicians even back then. The Phoenicians went all around. They were the experts on pretty much everything in the Eastern Mediterranean. Hiram of Tyre was the guy who not only ran trade going west, he also ran influence going east, inland. It was, this hard scrabble little nothing of a place, ruled by a minor despot called Solomon. Nothing. We wouldn't have made anyone's map had they been making maps. It took the Phoenicians to come and build a great palace, a great temple, but a great temple and a great palace for Solomon. It was Phoenician expertise that built the Temple of Jerusalem, the first temple. And put this place on the map. They were everywhere. They were in everybody's business, and everyone's consulting them for expertise. Well, how did that play into our story? Well, here we are again, Phoenicia and its cities. Sidon, you see Sidon on the map, sort of down two-thirds down the map, was the big player, the major Phoenician trading city until the 10th century. Then there's a short period when the Philistines took over that coast, but then Sidon and the Phoenicians recaptured it, and Tyre, who you see down there, becomes the major player. There's no Phoenicia, by the way. Phoenicia is just a geographical name. These were all independent city-states. We call them Phoenicians because they shared language, they shared culture, they shared a way of society, but they were all independent and often fought with each other. So there's really no Phoenicia except as a place where Phoenicians lived, just because a map could be. I never use that word Phoenicia because it is misleading. Homer talks about them a great deal, and when Homer calls them Sidonians, because when Homer's tales were being told, The very fact that Homer calls them Sidonians tells us or suggests that those tales predate the 10th century, because that's when Sidon was king of the trading. But later on, when Homer's stories are being written, Tyre had long been the dominant city. And yet Homer's calling them, that the tales are calling them Sidonians. Homer's writing down, whoever Homer is, was, or they were, writing down stories whose ancestor goes back to when the Sidonians were in charge, were the chief traders. And so it shows you there's a hint of how old those stories are. They go back to the Sidonian period. But Tyre becomes our main player in this lecture today. So the late Bronze Age collapse sends everybody, all the superpowers in the region, sends them reeling for a few centuries, destroys the Mycenaeans entirely, and the Hittites pretty much entirely. And as I said, in times of disaster, somebody's going to make some money. It's a dark cloud that does no one any good. And so entrepreneurial businessmen looking to take advantage of trade ops are now beginning to be dominated by Tyre. A bunch of traveling salesmen who saw the opportunity and hit the road. Spreading into the seas, looking for trade ops opportunities. It's what Ferdinand Brodel called the first or one of the early examples of world economy. Here were guys who were running an economy that included most of the area, what was then for them the known world. They were barbarians outside their area, but they didn't count. So the world economy was an early invention, or in this region at least, of the Phoenicians. Well, Cyprus was the first place we find them settling, moving to. Not settling, just moving to Cyprus. The Greeks had already been there. They'd been there under the Mycenaean period. 1400, Mycenaeans were there, 1400 BCE. Right after the late Bronze Age collapse, Greeks showed up as refugees from the destruction of the Dorian period back in Greece. So we had more Greeks landing in Cyprus. The Argolid, from Laconia, from Sparta area, from the town of Salamis on this map, suggesting that was settled by Greeks from Salamis, which is just off of Athens. So we have more evidence of the Greeks moving there. The Phoenicians, with Tyre leading the way, went there in the 9th century. And they settled, their main town was Kittian, which you see on the map. And it was under Itobal. Remember the Baal worshippers, all the kings were named after Baal. Itobal, as if Hannibal was a Carthaginian, again, from a Baal-worshipping society. But Itobal is an interesting fellow because he's the one who pawned his daughter Jezebel off to King Ahab, which did not go well, especially not for Jezebel. Israeli politics can be a snake pit. It still is. But anyway, in some place, sometimes both the Greeks and the Phoenicians came together at one place and settled the same place. And the influence is going back to Greece. I talked about Aphrodite already. Well, the Greeks always called Aphrodite Cypriot Aphrodite or Cyprian Aphrodite from Cyprus, because the greatest early worship sites of Aphrodite were on Cyprus. But when the Phoenicians came, they were probably Astarte sites. So you have this movement of changing the name of goddesses and moving some of her qualities. Some qualities change and some don't into the new goddess for the new people. So Aphrodite was always connected for the Greeks here. And so you have a sense of that movement, that relationship being brought across by the connection of the Phoenicians to the Greeks. Pottery styles merged and influence each other. Very clear evidences of what we didn't see in Greece of different potters influencing each other back in Greece in the Dark Ages. We do see it here on Cyprus. And some of them are very distinctly Cyprio-Mycenaean, or you see, Cyprio-Phoenician, but Cyprio is strongly Mycenaean. This red on black glaze is distinctly Mycenaean. So we have the Phoenicians already moving out and trading on their own volition. Then suddenly comes the hungry beast. Politics is never easy, and things change from unexpected ways. The Assyrians rise. And the Assyrians, after being pushed back by the late Bronze Age collapse, it took them a while to recover, and now they're coming back under different rulers and be recovering their former swagger. They were not seagoing people. They're from the upper Mesopotamia, Assur, and town. They don't They're not interested in the sea. They don't got any sense of businessmen in the old days. They didn't see any advantage. Notice they don't go, Tiglath-Pileser does not go to the coast. Didn't see a point.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
That changed. It changed under him, Ashurnasirpal II, 883. He decided that, circumstances lent itself to needing to apply more pressure to those people along the coast and to spread the empire. So here they come. The dates on this are a little wrong. It has 853 coming down, but actually 883 is more accurate for a general idea of what they were doing. The earliest movement of the Assyrians into the Lebanese area, Lebanese-Israel-Judah area. The Assyrians were terrifying. They were terrifying in their war fighting. They had tanks and armored battering rams. They did not relent, and their military was based upon tactics of terror. They would terrorize a city, destroy it, and you see the people being impaled in the center of that thing, impaling, flaying people. And then they let the word get out to the next city down the road, what they had just done. You were well advised to surrender, because what they did to those who didn't was horrifying. Ask Jonah, who was trying to escape going to Nineveh when the whale swallowed him and he had to change his mind. They also had a vast palace complex to keep in good. So the military needed weapons, and you need metals, and you needed income to pay the soldiers, to pay the army. You needed all the splendid goods you could get, silver, gold, fine crafted works for your great palaces, the Assyrian palaces at Nineveh. And so where do you get the money? Mesopotamia is wealthy, but not this wealthy. Well, you go to find good businessmen, and they found them. And so for a resources-starved superpower, the Phoenicians, they were able to, the Assyrians, they were wise enough, Ashurnasirpal, to get the Phoenicians to begin trading for them. And here are Phoenicians coming to honor the king, the next king down the road, Salamaster. That's Ashurnasirpal still. With goods, as well as copper, tin, fine linen garments, and in this case, a couple of monkeys. Delightful relief on the Assyrian palace. And obviously the monkeys are going to be part of the retinue of the palace. If you wanted it, the Phoenicians could get it for you. And if you were clever, you let them go. You let them do it. You didn't try to control them too much because you didn't know what you were doing, and they did. You made sure, though, that they were working for you. And this is what the Assyrians did. Notice now we have the Assyrians in control of the whole area, but the coast of Lebanon is white still because they did not occupy it. They simply made sure the Phoenicians were going to work for them in terms of their trading opportunities. Then they just let them do it. Phoenicia was unconquered because it was submissive. It was willing to work with the Assyrians because it was bad news if you didn't. So off they go. And the Phoenicians had even more pressure to go west. Head off to the Mediterranean to get. And where do you find the metals? The best metals were all the way across the Mediterranean at the far end in Spain, Hispania, the Iberian Peninsula. Notice this is a series of mass deportations under Shalmaneser and Sargon II. One thing the Assyrians were clever enough to do, which was when they conquered a place, it was to deport the population so that they weren't concentrated enough to revolt against you. And thus the 10 tribes of Israel were scattered to the winds across the landscape and merged with the local populations, and that was it. The two tribes left down in Judah were the remnant of what became the Jewish people, but the rest of them were simply merged into the Assyrian population by Assyrian policy. Well, back up a little bit. Now, how did this begin and affect our story? Well, here we have the Assyrians coming down, and we have the Phoenicians hitting the road, hitting the seas with their ships. Got to get them moving again. Well, some of you will know this is a warship, and we're talking merchants. So forget it. We'll talk. Here's a relief or a sketch made from a relief of both kinds of ships, warships and merchant ships. And these ships aren't actually not doing trade. They're migrating. Because also at this period comes the story of Elisa, who migrates with, deprived of her rights as the queen of Tyre. She and her followers head out west and found Carthage, and she becomes Dido, queen of Carthage. And Aeneas comes along, and grand opera ensues, and you know all that. But so that's not the right kind of picture. How about this? He's a cargo ship. You can tell it's a cargo ship by the crane, loading up goods on and off the ship. Here's one. By 850 BCE, we find increased Mesopotamia goods in Greece, archaeologists, indicating that this very moment when the Phoenicians were pressuring them to go do more trade, the Phoenicians were increasing trade everywhere, and we find evidence of it happening in Greece, in the Aegean. And there they were. You find Phoenician ships in ports all around the Mediterranean. I'm delighted that this fellow made one. And here's the ancient relief of it. Everything from silver ingots to fine linens. What matters is that they trade. What matters to the Assyrians is that they do lots of trade so they can get lots of income and bring stuff to the Assyrians. And the Assyrians reward them for it. And, I mean, the businessman works for the warrior as much as the warrior works for the businessman. And it's a mutual beneficial relationship. So you have Phoenician trading posts everywhere. We're concerned with the ones in the Aegean Sea. At Rhodes, you guys, I hope you know where Rhodes is right there, is probably the largest one, right at the edge of the Aegean. What you see the Phoenicians doing is they're establishing, leaving here, they're establishing posts all along their movement. You don't go across open water if you can, so you follow the line of these dots and then go up here, cross over here and follow the line of dots. That's how you would sail, because without a compass, you didn't want to get out of sight of land if you could avoid it. And so you see Phoenician trading posts dotted along the route of travel for the ships heading towards the far west, Iberian Peninsula. This is the mercantile business. We find them in our area, that is the Greece area, a couple of places. You find them at Thassos, which is the north part of the Aegean, which is where the silver mines were, or gold mines. They were probably doing gold. Also silver mines there, but I don't think they did silver. They did gold there. You find them at Crete, certainly, and in Rhodes, certainly. And you find them the island of Kythera, where your mechanism comes from. Kythera, if you will. And then you have legends talking about them other places, but the archaeology can't support that. But archaeology supports a handful. But these aren't settlements. They aren't coming there to live. These aren't colonies. These are trading posts. They may last a few decades, and they may not. They're just places to come to take care of the ships that pass through and to get the resources from the interior. One resource that they wanted was iron, but the technology had to be imported to do it. The Greeks had lost the ability to. They didn't really have the ability to smelt iron. We're just now at the beginning of the Iron Age. Iron is harder to work than copper, than bronze. And why would anyone bother with iron? Iron was available. You could dig it up. But why would anyone bother with iron? Because it's harder to work with until you figured out that it was much better once you had begun to smelt it and carbonize it and temper it. But it was hard work. They suspected that perhaps there's a tin shortage because you need tin to make bronze. And perhaps there's a tin shortage. Why they began using iron. And soon they figured out. This is one of the earliest examples of iron being smelted, about 5th, 6th century BC. The smelter and an assistant, his son perhaps, or a slave, hard to say. But we find a bit of iron here. There's a remarkable discovery made in Euboea, which is Lefkandi, of a woman with two gold breastplates, and buried with her are her horses, with iron bits. You see them? And so not a lot of iron, a complicated iron work, but enough to make iron bits, and perhaps they were imported. But the gold was certainly imported. So here in the middle of the Dark Ages is evidences that of some trade going on, and some people with enough money and Ionians, not Dorians, enough money to work with trading. So some's going on, but not a lot. It's still pretty dark. But being able to work iron is a good thing, because once you master it, the implements are much better. It's much better metal. And that's why the Bronze Age gave way to the Iron Age, including safety pins. Very important to hold your clothes together. They are exactly like safety pins. There's no difference in that in the ones we buy, except they're bigger, because you had more cloak to hold, a cloak. Weapons are better and farming tools are better. And Greece needs all the help it could get because the soil's so bad. Okay, so you have Euboea. That's where Lefkandi was, is right there. Euboea, you can see it right there. Pretty close to where the trading routes would have been in and out of the Mediterranean, out of the Aegean. You right there. And so that's, we find a sort of a center of trade coming in. Well, I've been a little disingenuous. It wasn't quite all that dark, the Dark Ages. Obviously, I've shown you that there was movement going on. There were spots of light in this darkness of trade coming in and out, but not a lot. It's really darker in that sense than the Dark Ages of European civilization, because when Rome fell, what was left? Well, the two great children of Rome, the Byzantine Empire, which is a continuation of Rome, and the church, Christian church, which adopted so much of the Roman value system and Roman ritual and such. So Rome left two very powerful children behind her and through the Dark Ages to keep that civilization rolling forward. And then the Arabs also kept the intellectual side going forward of Rome. That, we still call that the Dark Ages. Well, the Mycenaeans and Minoans left nothing like that. There were no descendants. It was the only people to rescue that dark Greece out of its doldrums was going to be somebody from outside that was not a part of the Mycenaean or Minoan world, and that was the Phoenicians. So here we are. They were backwards and nearly forgotten, and Professor Ober will elucidate perhaps in this program about how modern social science can talk about how they were awakened out of these doldrums. But I'm going to use the fuzzy logic of myth. And we're going to close this in mythic garments and begin with the Rape of Europa. So one day a Phoenician princess went down to the shore. Best I could find for a Phoenician princess. This is the right shore, at least. And she often did so. Well, the earliest example of this story is from the Iliad, and it takes place at Tyre. Well, her father was King Agenor, also called King Canaan, so hence we have the Canaanite connection, who ruled Tyre. And he was a son of a sea god, Poseidon. He was son of Poseidon and a woman called Libya, who connects us to North Africa. But anyway, so Agenor and his wife Telephassa had one daughter and five sons. The sons, Cadmus, Phoenix, Kilix, Thasus, and Peneus. Europa, their daughter's name, meant broad-faced, perhaps referring to the moon goddess, Astarte, or dark-faced, perhaps referring to the west, where land where darkness comes from. Anyway, one night Europa had a dream, and two women appeared to her in a dream. Each wanted her for her own. One woman was called Asia in the dream. And Asia told her, and she knew this woman. Oh, yes, I know you well. And Asia said, stay with me, do not leave me. Another woman will want to take you away, but don't go, stay with me. I was the mother who gave birth to you and nursed you. Another woman appeared in the dream, with a strange woman whose name was unknown. And she whispered to Europa, God has decreed, Europa, that you will go with me. So Europa awoke from her dream, excited and also afraid. Well, she went down to the shore with her friends, as they often did, and gathering shells and enjoying themselves. They were princesses one day. And one day, she noticed on the beach a bull. And the bull was standing there, shining snow-white bull, with a very beautiful and gentle nature. And she approached the bull and stroked its coat. And the bull nuzzled up against her. And playfully, she climbed up. The bull said, climb on my, didn't say, but indicated she could climb on my back. She climbed on the back of the bull, this gentle bull. You notice in this Roman fresco that the bull is looking right at us. The Roman artist is making us complicit in the crime that's about to happen, because the bull is looking right at us, which is an interesting psychological thing to do in a fresco like that. Anyway, and he begins trotting along the shore with her on his back. Well, you know what happens next. The bull jumps into the surf and begins swimming away. And Europa cries out for help. But her friends could do nothing. Of course, the bull was Zeus. We all know that. Who often disguised himself to trick mortal girls and disguised himself also to hide from his jealous wife. I mean, it's a hard chore to be the fertile agent of the divine energy, to be the agent of transformation in the world, and have someone looking over your shoulder criticizing you all the time and feeling jealous about it. The job of Zeus as the sky god is to rain his fertility on the earth. That's and the earth gives birth. And so that he's trying to do that, and then people don't gets people upset. Anyway, Zeus carried Europa across the seas, accompanied by dolphins and his son Triton and Poseidon along. And she hung on desperately, and they got to Crete, and there she was raped. And subsequently, she gave birth to three children, Minos, Sarpedon, and Rhadamanthus. And they grew up to be wise, law-giving kings and the bringers of civilization. And then when they died, they went to the underworld and became judges of the underworld. Well, Agenor was not, back to the story, Agenor was not thrilled. He was desperate to get his daughter back. She sends all five sons out after the daughter. And don't come back unless you find her. If you don't find her, don't come back. So off they go. All sons eventually gave up the search. They failed to find her, couldn't go home. So they stayed where they landed. Son Phoenix didn't go very far. He landed on a nearby coast and became a king of a town up the coast, and they gave his name to their region, Phoenicia, the Phoenicians. Kilix became king of Cilicia, which is right up there in the upper part of that coast, right where it meets Turkey, Cilicia, and he became king there. The town is Tarsus, where later a guy named Paul was born from Tarsus. Thasus went up to found the city of Thasos, which is Thyros on this map, the top end of the Aegean. And these are all places where we find Phoenician influence. History also, the myth is connecting to history. Herodotus says that Thasos was founded by the Phoenicians. The myth says it, and sure enough, archaeology agrees. And Peneus settled in Thrace. Thrace is just on the other side of that, still at the north end of the, up in Macedonia now on that map. And he became king of Thrace. Cadmus, well, hold that moment. So now we have a story talking about the movement of Phoenician civilization westward across the Aegean, the transfer of Phoenician civilization to Crete in the form of Europa. So we're telling in mythic terms a historical event. And then we have a story of Minos, her son, as king of Crete, moving back and forth to Tyre. So it's suggesting, in truth, there was commerce between these two places. And we establish a Phoenician presence in the Aegean by point of the story. Also, if you look at this is from my Sicily collection. And so Sicily's in green. And in the western portion of Sicily is the town of Salinas. And way out there, they made this relief for their temple of the rape of Europa because the Western Greeks were perfectly willing, perfectly happy and important to celebrate this this movement, this story. As why they are out there is thanks to Europa and the movement of Europa. What about that fifth son, Cadmus? Well, there he is. Cadmus went out also looking for his daughter. His name comes from the Phoenician for east, perhaps for east. So he's connected to the east in his through his name. He traveled with his brother Thasos, who ended up to the north part of the Aegean. He stayed in central Aegean. At the last minute, his mom Telephassa decided to go along with him. Which, I mean, how heroic can a guy be when his mom's going along? But anyway, she does. So off he goes from Tyre down here. You see Tyre all the way to the Aegean looking for his sister. And he goes to Delphi. See Delphi up there in the top of your screen. And the Delphic oracle, he consults the oracle about this whole business. And the oracle says, forget it. Forget your sister. Don't look for your sister anymore. However, what I want you to do is look for a special cow. You'll meet a cow on your travels with a half moon on its flank. And when you leave it, follow the cow until the cow lies down exhausted, and then you build a town on that spot. And soon enough, he comes to the cow. And You know how hard it is to find a picture of a cow with a half moon on his flank? So I did the best I could. He meets this cow given by the king of Phocis, and the cow wandered into Boeotia, and in Boeotia the cow lay down, and he said, "Here's my new city. I'm going to call it Thebes." And he's going to sacrifice the cow to Athena. And but meanwhile, as he's waiting to sacrifice the cow to Athena, he sends his men off to the Castalian Spring to get some water. Bad idea. The guardian dragon of the spring kills his men. So Cadmus runs off, jumps up there and runs off and kills the dragon. And too late, as all his companions are now all dead. But Athena then shows up, who's always around there when heroic deeds are being done, and she tells him to sow the teeth of the dragon out in the ground. This is copied in many other stories, Jason for one. Sow the seeds. So he does, and he sows the seeds into the ground, and from the ground spring a race of armed men. And Cadmus throws a precious jewel into the middle of the armed men because they're dangerous, and they all begin to fight each other until they kill each other off, and only five are left. And those five become his loyal companions. And then he builds a great citadel on Thebes, which archaeology says dates back to the Mycenaean period. And the citadel is called the Cadmea, and it always was in the ancient Greek period because they attributed it to Cadmus building this great citadel in the town of Thebes. And this is Thebes, Greece. Don't confuse it with Thebes, Egypt. And the five followers became the great families of the original great families of Thebes. Well, the problem is the dragon had been sacred to Ares. And so Ares made Cadmus do penance for 8 years for having killed his sacred dragon. And at the end of that period, he gives him a wife, Harmonia, who's a daughter of Electra, and she's also semi-divine. The wedding happens someplace, Samothrace, possibly in Thrace. All the gods were present. It was the last event in myth where the gods and humans came together in the same event. This is why Colosso wrote the book. It's a theme in Colosso's book. The last time that people spoke with gods on equal terms. And the failure of that to happen again proves humanity is growing up in one way of looking at it. Unfortunately, Cadmus contained his whole life was plagued by ill fortune because of having killed the dragon. And finally, he told the gods, "This is ridiculous. If you value the life of a serpent so much that you make my life miserable, then turn me into a serpent." No problem. Immediately he began to grow scales and change in form. And Harmonia, seeing his transformation, says, "Oh, no, don't take him. Turn me into a serpent too." And so they both become serpents. And I love this because it's the reversal of the Eden story. Eden is paradise. We leave paradise. We're estranged from nature. All the rest of history, once we left paradise, we and nature are opposed in the Hebrew story. Well, here we have us going back and becoming serpents ourselves. And the serpent is a thing of the earth, the female earth, the earth mother. And the serpent is an earth-worshipping animal. And it was much honored as an animal of the earth. It took the Hebrews, who were trying to distance themselves from the good serpent idea of the Mesopotamians, to make a bad serpent idea. But that's a different story. But anyway, they go back into serpents, which I think is lovely. The final story here is that Herodotus credits Cadmus for bringing the Phoenician alphabet to Greece. He says it's 1,600 years before his own time, with about 2,000 BCE. That's not right. That's not historical. But the truth is, the story of Cadmus bringing the alphabet means the Phoenicians brought the alphabet to Greece, and Cadmus becomes the vehicle for that. In Lebanon, Cadmus is still called the mythic carrier of writing to all the world. And so we have the spread of civilization westward. Civilization brought from the Near East to Europe. And it gave us a situation in which the Phoenician culture, now the brown on your map, represents a culture that spread all across the Mediterranean. And so bringing civilization to the Mediterranean and therefore to the world and through the Greeks and the Carthaginians to Rome, and through them to us. And that story is exponential. And of course, once the alphabet arrived, the alphabet becomes almost simultaneously, in fact, here it is. Simultaneously, in the 8th century, the 700s, you have a population increase. You have the first Olympic Games, 776. You have the Greeks developing a writing system based on the Phoenician model, you have Homer and Hesiod writing down the stories of who the Greeks had. So suddenly, the Greeks became the Greeks. The Greeks were invented at this moment, the Greek nation. Before, you had Greek-speaking peoples all isolated from each other. Now, a nation is defined as a bunch of people, all the same culture, the same language, who share a geographical area. And for the first time in the 8th century, the Greeks began to feel that way. And they felt that way because the alphabet wrote down their stories, and now they could all share the stories and realize that they all had mostly the same stories. The Olympic Games shows them coming together as Greeks for the first time. And so in the 8th century, you find all these influences, and I credit the Phoenicians with giving that spark that brought the Greek people together and gave them a sense of what it means to be Greek and a sense of Greekness. So thank you.
I'd like to remind our audience that they're listening to Douglas Kenning. He just finished a lecture on the Rape of Europa, how the Phoenicians brought civilization to the Greeks in their Dark Ages. And we have time for a few questions.
We'll be quiet.
We would like to ask.
Is there any sense that a part of the fall of the Mycenaeans might have had anything to do with massive infection or some sort of a plague?
Not really. The plague idea is not one I've given much credence to. I've heard it, but it didn't. I haven't talked, since my subject wasn't why the Mycenaeans fell, other than the late Bronze Age invasions. It was population, climate change. It was the destruction of the forests. There are environmental reasons for that late Bronze Age collapse as well. So there are a number of theories out there as to how that happened.
So I have a question about the geography of the seaports.
Yes.
On the Levant coast.
Yes.
Are there many? How different is that geography from the ports that are on the Aegean Peninsula, the Greek ports? And I mean, are there deep water ports at Tyre and Sidon?
Tyre had to put itself off on an island off coast to get its deep water port, and that made it pretty much invulnerable, or almost, until Alexander the Great showed up. Sidon also had a pretty good deep water harbor, and that's the reason that those two people prospered when the others didn't quite have the deep water. But you didn't have to have much deep water. These ships did not draw much. We're not talking about huge cargo ships. Byblos started it all. Byblos is the one who invented the keel. And it was Byblos' ships who were able to teach the Egyptians, help the Egyptians build their temples because they could move large timbers, which the Egyptians couldn't do in their ships. So the Byblos started at Sidon next and Tyre next. But the ports, by our standards, aren't that remarkable. But in the age, they were in the right place at the right time is essentially what the Phoenicians did. Yeah.
You talk about Phoenician writing. But sorry, you talk about the Phoenician writings, specifically the alphabetic writing. Yes, thank you. But I was interested in seeing how did they move from Sumerian cuneiform to Phoenician?
Exactly. Well, these languages are not related languages. The line doesn't show that the languages evolved into each other. It shows how the alphabet went. And the alphabet, the Phoenicians is a Semitic language. It has nothing to do with the language that the Greeks spoke in Greece. But what the Greeks saw... And here's a better example. I have a slide for this. There. What the Greeks saw was that there were 22 letters in the Phoenician alphabet. The Greeks were able to, because the alphabet is all consonants. It's a Semitic alphabet. There's no vowels. The Greek language, they wanted vowels. The Semitic peoples assume that you'll figure out the vowels in context. But the Greeks took some letters, and some of the letters of the Phoenicians in the Phoenician language had no sound equivalents in Greek. So there were extra letters that weren't being used when you borrowed their alphabet. And you said, I want, you know, this sound in my language will go to this letter, this sound to this letter. But there were some letters that were extra, and the Greeks turned those into vowels. And so the Greeks added vowels, and for the first time in human history, a language looked like it sounded. And that was a remarkable change. And the Greeks were the first to add vowels. This, by the way, this being Semitic, it reads right to left. The Greeks also borrowed the names of the letters, Alph, Beth, Gimel, Daleth, A, B, C. And you also see the figure, the animals, and the images that the original form that they were being imitated. So it's about the sound of your language, the vowels of your language, and the syllables. So the syllables of your language and the letter, the vowels and the consonants and the letters that you use to represent them. So unrelated languages can still learn alphabets from each other.
So you're saying the French undid that, right?
The French undid that, yes. Well, yeah.
Next question.
Anyway?
By the way, one curious detail. Why was one map in Russian?
I find maps that show me what I want. And I don't care what the language is. I wanted the dots.
Yeah.
I knew what the dots were. And I
understood that. That was great.
Yeah.
I'm interested in something I think of as the Promethean formula, which is blank brings blank to humankind and the gods and is punished by the gods.
Yes.
And so is the Cadmus myth is it the earliest known version of this, or like, do you have some idea where this formula comes from? And, you know, I think that it's most familiar to us through Prometheus, except that it's true of Enoch. And yeah, I mean, there are so many examples of it.
In a general way, you can take that back. I mean, when Gilgamesh goes to the forests of Lebanon and gets a cedar and brings it back to Babylon, to Mesopotamia, which doesn't have good wood, he ends up getting everybody, all the gods, angry at him. And he's punished for it. And his best friend Enkidu is killed. It's not quite bringing all good things, but there's one example of bringing benefit to his people and being punished by the gods who didn't want him to have such hubris. And the idea that hubris brings punishment is itself a common theme. And it's not only the Greeks. Greeks made it one of their central tenets, but it's not only Greek. It's a good question. And one could sit down for a while. And I'd probably go back to Egypt and think about it and come up with examples. But I'd like to hear that thesis expanded. Is the way it plays out in many cultures. You know, no good deed goes unpunished. I understand that, yeah.
Still true today.
Yeah.
Time for one last question. Anybody like to ask it?
Where can I get a red cap that says, make Mycenae great again?
Have it made and I'll buy one.
There's a website for everything.
Yes.
All right, thank you very, very much, Douglas. And so ends another event in the Commonwealth Club's history, 116 years of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.